Now? Oh yeah, we're good. We're on. Let's do it.
What does that mean?
We're rolling.
Oh, that's like the clapper buzz.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. Hey, guys.
Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Natalie.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
I think our reputation speaks for itself. This is Mike from the band Fucked Up.
And yourself? That's Jonah.
From the band Fucked Up.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
And I'm Natalie. I used to work at Mardo. During 2008, well, for many years, but including 2008, which is when...
Hadn't you have just kind of started working there?
I had.
Yeah.
I'm not actually sure exactly when it... I probably should know that, but I also probably should have looked up.
Where did we meet you? I think I remember maybe Camden Barfly gig.
This is what I was also going to ask. Can you... Because I can't... I have no idea when we first met. But the record came out 2008.
Mm.
And had you been over before then to the UK?
Yeah, probably like 100 times
already. Yeah, but...
We used to come like 6 times a year.
Or yeah.
Something.
But do you think that's where we met, Camden Barfly?
I think that's the first time I remember being introduced to you.
Right.
It was a pre-chemistry show. We were... I don't know. We played at Barfly. We had our picture taken by Gavin Watson. Does that track as a timeline thing? It was like February 2008.
I think that was already 8.
All right.
Did you go to Tales of the Jackalope Festival?
Yeah.
Maybe
that
was
before 8, right?
The summer of 2008? Or...
I think we did it in 6 or 7, and that was the year we flew over and played one song, and then they shut the festival down.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any other shows in England, so we flew over to play...
One song and then flew
literally
home.
One song and then flew home, yeah. Because of the fall.
Right.
And who's the headliner that festival?
They couldn't
play. They cancelled the whole thing.
Wait, so what ended up happening at the festival?
The festival had planning permission for noise levels, but our set was so loud, a farmer one extra field away complained to the council, and they shut it down.
Yeah. And then that was that.
I heard it was because also we were like an hour and a half late going on stage because Mark E. Smith did like a 2-hour sound check or something, like on stage.
I mean, he probably fucked the decibel levels because he was changing the levels of the amps of the other members of The Fall as the set was happening.
Very on brand.
And hitting them and stuff.
Yeah. Wait, so you flew over, played one song, then flew back.
Yeah.
Great.
And they put us on like a very budget airline, and that was in my era of being the most afraid of flying in my life. Oops. And we had to fly from like a different city, and I'm still stressed out about it.
Mm.
And the airline doesn't exist anymore.
Nope.
Yeah, we fly Globespan.
We stopped over in Belfast, and I think we had visas at that point, and there was a necessary thing to like report your entrance into the UK for administrative purposes, but because we landed in Belfast and they didn't process our paperwork at all, and then you don't have to, so there's no border between
Ireland. You do customs in Ireland.
So we didn't get our thing stamped, and our booking agent sort of flipped out. But what can you do?
But you made it back.
Still here to tell the tale.
So let's rewind slightly. How did the Matador deal come about pre-ChemCon release?
There was some interest moving around.
I remember we played that really small Polish place, Europa, in New York, and it was like pure hardcore era, and Patrick and Chris were there, like both just wearing suits and like mocks and stuff. Or Max,
mocks,
yeah, those long coats.
Mac the week,
Max.
Yeah,
I thought you were meaning moccasins.
Mock the knife,
right?
And just being the like looking like detectives at the hardcore show,
really standing out.
Yeah, they chatted us up,
mm-hmm.
and then I think it took like 2 years to figure it all out with the aforementioned Paul Summerstein, our entertainment lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were working on the record at the same time as working on the contract, which both took many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they finished them both probably on the same day, and 6 months later the record came out.
So you probably first met them just after Hidden World had come out.
Probably six or seven. Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
The I think I first met them after we signed, I think. And we went down for one day to New York. It was the most glamorous thing that had ever happened to me at that point. Mm-hmm. There was Mike and Josh said, "Do you want to go for a meeting?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, sure." Oh no, that's not true. We first met them in the most unglamorous day ever. Mm-hmm. Patrick and Lombardi and possibly Gerard too flew to Toronto, mm-hmm. and we took them to this pokey little dumper restaurant in the West End of Toronto, and they were so unimpressed. The Butler's Pantry.
Was that when we had, played like, a Christmas
microwave shepherd's pie?
We played a Christmas benefit show, right? And
yeah.
That they came to, and yeah. then it snowed so hard they missed all their flights.
Oh wow!
But I don't think we hung out with them like on their extra days. They just did their own thing.
But then, in inverse, like the next meeting we had with them, I think they flew us to New York, and we had some insane sushi meal, and it was like far beyond the station of fucked up at that point.
Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did you make of them?
I think everybody's friendly.
Yeah.
Straight away. So to this day, I have no concept of their personalities whatsoever. There's two nice guys I met 20 years ago.
Well, there goes all your questions.
That's right.
No.
They seem like three, like, you know, when people sometimes describe people's dynamics as like ego, super ego, and id.
Mm-hmm.
Probably when you're with the three of them, they're all that.
Yeah, but who's who?
Well, that's the thing. It was so long ago that I haven't seen any of those people. Like, I don't think I've seen Gerard in like 10 years. But Gerard's the chillest one, right?
You tell me.
I remember I stayed at his house once, which somebody told me was a rare thing. I like
that is a very rare thing.
So being afraid of flying, mm-hmm. we played South by Southwest once, and I was in Chicago and. Instead of taking like a 45-minute flight down to Austin, I was like, no, I think I'm going to take the train, which took 2 days. Oh, and the schedule of it meant that I like got there a couple days early. And so I stayed at Gerard's house. And I remember I got there and the festival had sort of already started. And he was mm-hmm. like, he let me in and he's like, I'm going to a show. So enjoy yourself. And then like this massive dog came stepping out of the dog room. And I was also very afraid of dogs. And it was like a big dog, and those are the, you know, they can tell if you are afraid of them, and they
can smell,
they really
fear.
Lap it up. So I remember just like the whole time Gerard was gone, I'm just like, because I would pet the dog, and if I would stop, it would growl. So I just sat on the couch petting Gerard's dog for probably 4 hours without stopping, and then he came home, and then I never went back there.
You did go back, because we crashed at his place one time. The dog was still there, and we did some sort of like overnight drive from, not overnight, a few hours, but across Texas anyway. And sure. We had nowhere to stay, and Damien had the bright idea to just, oh, we'll just call Gerard, stay with him. So it's like 1 a.m, hey Gerard, we're 2 hours away, can you let us in, can we crash at your place? And he begrudgingly let us in, but it was very comfortable.
How was the record collection?
And I love
floor to ceiling.
Yeah,
I think that especially Damien and I were like kind of impressed in those days. I mean, maybe we still are. Damien definitely is, but it was just like, you know, Gerard had been around for all this 80s hardcore,
mm-hmm.
Which at that point, I mean, and so had Chris and so had Patrick. So mm-hmm. And that was part of my first impression anyway. It was like, oh yeah, Lombardi played in like a lineup of G.G. Allin's band,
mm-hmm.
and Patrick put out the Death Wish record, and Gerard did, what was it, Forced Exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these tenuous things, at that point, I mean, I had far more tunnel vision than Mike, who has always a longer plan in mind, but like, you know, I was still hardcore and you know, discovering these new capabilities to make something that was maybe a bit more widely interesting, but these people were like grounding me in a mm-hmm. sense, and it was okay to dip our toes in this part of the world, because all of a sudden there's this deep connection to the little shadowy corner of music that I've mm-hmm. decided to obsess over, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that colored my first impression.
So Chemistry hadn't been written before you signed the deal. You said it was happening like concurrently.
I think like that was back in the days when I would write a guitar part like in my room.
Yeah.
And record it onto a tape, a cassette or something. And then we would practice for like a year or two. Mm-hmm. So it was written, but it took like a year to record and write in the studio. And also we were like, we would record for a couple weeks and then go on tour. I think we had like 2 or 3 long sessions, mm-hmm. and then just like 6 or 8 months of dicking around, kind of just mm-hmm. adding the stupid instruments like flutes or violins or whatever.
I feel like chemistry to me was way more compact than that. I mean, there was definitely some noodling, and I would bring my 8-track to your house and we'd play into that. It was at your West End place by Kiel. And you had an Akai head rush pedal, which was responsible for some early loops, especially those instrumental tracks. But in my mind, that the chemistry session was just like 14, 15 straight days of stuff mm-hmm. that maybe felt like it was too. I mean, there was stuff afterwards, but like the flute intro to Son the Father, I'm pretty sure that got added in situ during the main session. There was a big problem with some intonation on a guitar again in this session. It was all very like one-to-one between how we were making the music in the practice space and how we were recording it. And these mm-hmm. problems that usually get eliminated in the studio in terms of good equipment, good tuners, reliable, replicable results, totally out the window as usual with us. Like, mm-hmm. and that stuff is kind of easier for us now because we write strictly in the studio, but at that point it was like trying to replicate this moment of creativity as a group under pressure, red light fever, that kind of thing.
So was it a different process to recording?
It was really linear. It was really linear. It was like get the drums, overdub the guitars, mm-hmm. maybe get the 2 guitars at the same time, do some dumb experimentation, bring the organ. The person who played Hammond organ, he mm-hmm. wheeled his own huge Leslie speaker into the studio, which was as cold as this room is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hours and hours in this big, dark, high-ceiling, vaulted room while everybody else watched movies on a tiny 20-inch tube TV. Mm-hmm. So it was good.
And it was a new studio for you.
We'd done Hidden World there.
You had.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that was the best of our reach at that time.
But do you think it changed the record? And did you sort of know that you were going to sign to Matador? And did that change what the record was going to be?
No. Cool. Okay, so it was like a year of deciding between Matador and Vice. Mm. And we had sort of made friends with people on, you know, both labels. So it became very tricky after a year of just like, we basically just had to like flip a coin. Mm-hmm. But
I found an article. It's the only thing I printed out.
Of?
This was printed in Vice.
Oh, like fuck them.
It was Andy interviewing you.
Oh, yeah.
So Andy Kappa from Vice. Hey, Mike. Remember the night you told me you were going to sign to Matador instead of Vice? What are your recollections of that evening? Mike. It's a blur. Talking to you is all I can remember and worrying a lot about the whole thing. It wasn't a great vibe. Andy. I smashed the staircase banister next to my desk. I couldn't believe how mad I got. I kicked it, I think. Mike. You guys both cussed Damien over the phone, remember?
I said cussed?
Mm-hmm. Andy. Yeah, me and Sarush rang him up. I slammed down the phone on him. I'm pretty sure I said the words, fuck Chris Lombardi and fuck those guys about 6,000 times that night.
Yeah.
Mike, it was a bad vibe. Damien was really bummed.
I remember, like, one of the pivotal moments, maybe it was after we were, like, in Austin, probably, maybe it was the same year. But, like, Sarush took me or Damien. Okay, so we were having lunch at one of those barbecue places.
Yeah.
And, I don't remember even who it was, if it was me or not. But, like, somebody was taken down to, like, the riverbank. Do you remember this? And, like, Sarush.
Sounds like it's going to be a hit.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so there was a lot of stern talking to's. But as far as professionalism, like, yeah, on one hand, okay, so we did record a lot at
Hala Music,
but then we did overdubs at Lauren's place for like 9 months,
right?
I remember that now. So those 9 months I was doing emails with Paul, and I was what, 27 or whatever, and I was mm-hmm. like emailing a lawyer about a contract and then doing like overdubs and like having guests come in and stuff. So on one hand, thinking that like we're like the most professional musicians that have ever existed, but then actually talking to people at labels who are like seem like grown-ups and have real jobs and stuff, and still like we still feel like amateurs, you know. Mm-hmm. And so
I can confirm that
that record in particular, there you go, sounds like the job that the engineer did made it sound like a really bright, clean, polished thing, but it's like, it's pretty chaotic musically.
Yeah.
And all the ideas we were having were stuff that we were just like, what if we did this stupid thing? Like all the other instruments, and the songwriting was, we weren't we weren't really going for it, if that's what you're saying.
I think, well, it's weird because at that point in everybody's creative lives, going for it meant asking the question, what if?
Yeah.
And instead of just, you know, activating something that answers that question for you, it's like, what if, indiscriminate what if questions, that's sort of how the pushing happened. But those records existed in earnest in demo form in ways that there's a 4-track demo of, I think, Albino and Chemistry and Twice Born or something that we did in our practice room. It's a room this big that sounded like the Wipers or something. Yeah. Like that's the other side of that record, is that it was kind of like the stretch of our imagination almost existed in the past tense.
Mm-hmm.
And getting into these other spaces and then having the occasion of being signed to a big label means that you're, even if your imagination is still small, it changes context instantly. What if all of a sudden becomes, we're pushing boundaries instead of just like, yeah, this is a laugh. So I, you know, signing to a label, I think for me, colored my opinion of those decisions.
Sure.
It made it into something that all of a sudden had an intention rather than no consequence.
Mm. Well, we already were signed to a label though.
J Tree?
Yeah. We had to be bought out of J Tree.
No, I know, but signing to J Tree, as you recall, it's like I got really drunk after a show in Streetsville and yelled at you in the car. Well, that yelled towards you. We're ruining everything. We built so much. Why?
Who said that?
That was me. Oh. I think it was like a career suicide show and got really drunk. And
I don't think I was there.
You were there because you and Lisa drove me home. And I had like a drunken mumble about it. But, you know, J Tree was just like, okay, this band took a thing that was already done and they pushed it into I'm the most naive one in the group. So for me, it meant like, whatever. I'm still going to be drumming in my punk band.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. So these things kind of like, Matador was like a bucket of cold water over my head in terms of trying to like understand what it meant to be in this group. It totally changed the context for me.
I feel like a lot of the punk community were pissed off at you though.
Eh, take a number.
It felt like then, like, so the record preview, like Hidden World came out in 2006. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was a smaller scale thing. So at that time, it kind of felt like we were a hardcore group that was like making experimental hardcore.
Yeah.
And within two years and half of that time, we were just writing music the same way. Yeah, it did feel like we had overnight become like an indie band who was like writing like aggressive music.
Mm-hmm.
It had like really flipped over. And maybe just because like, Chemistry is, to me, sounds, it's like raw and faster and weirder to the first record, but it was on Matador.
Mm-hmm.
And which only really meant that like different people were paying attention to it.
Mm.
I think it's like still a weirder album and still, you know, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
But perceptions outside the band changed a lot.
Yeah.
For sure.
I mean, it definitely changed things in terms of like, you know, you guys had like a big press team working on it and radio team, and I guess it just became like a bigger thing, and I guess a lot of people,
it was like marginally bigger, but again, like I also felt at the time that we were like, in terms of getting bigger, it was in the context of like we were getting bigger with people like Jay and like No Age and stuff,
yeah,
and Mika Miko, and sort of like DIY bands were just getting bigger as like this wave of still like weird, difficult music, rather than like any of those artists trying to be more polished or anything.
Yeah,
like the next record obviously is poppier, but
sure,
I didn't really know anything about Matter's discography or anything, because I just, still back then, I was just listening to like soul or techno or like Disfear or like just really extreme music. We just kind of got swept up in a thing that had nothing to do with the five and a half of us.
Yeah. I remember we went up to Bradford for that show.
Oh yeah. At the 1 in 12.
At the 1 in 12 club. I don't know. Is it still there?
Yeah. The one on 12? Still do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And they were very, very... the regulars there were very, very pissed off.
Well, that was the famous NME out of punk Trojan horse.
Yeah. But that was in jest because NME. All those people were like our friends. Yeah. And I remember, yeah, they made like a cardboard Trojan horse, like like football hooligan style. But it was like...
For context, like we'd gone up there because NME put Damien on the cover. Yeah.
Did we not take the photo in Bradford?
At yeah, it the was just at a Tesco or something.
The cover photo was in a butcher's shop.
Yeah.
In Bradford, I think we went and bought like
the insert really where gross. We were.
Like it was like a cow's heart or a sheep's heart or something. It was disgusting. But then the insert photo where Damien is completely naked, kind of doing a Silence of the Lambs.
But that was that in the 1 in 12?
It was at the back of the 1 in 12.
They do other things.
Yeah. But then I think like the regulars of the 1 in 12, which is like a, you know, amazing legendary club where it's like proper punks go there. Yeah. And they were really, really pissed off that the NME was in.
But those people probably didn't even it didn't feel like we were big enough to like have a real backlash at that point, you know? Because like
I remember being a bit scared.
No.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know. Are you a bit scared right now though doing this? Like we were still just playing DIY like basements and stuff, and it's like there wasn't ever going to be a racket of people that were like pissed that we signed to. You know, I always felt like most people don't care what you don't look at the label usually unless you're into the label, right? Mm. Like just a band getting a few more fans and like a bit more press and stuff. Mm-hmm. And playing a lot more shows.
And there were a lot of shows.
Yeah.
What did we top out at in a year? Like 150 or something?
Yeah, those years probably like 120 or 150. It still doesn't feel like that much, but...
Does Sandy still keep a note of every single show?
We have a list.
Yeah.
But that, it just kind of felt like, okay, now we're... Because I remember like the five of us all just... We all like had a meeting at Sandy's house in 2007, and we were all like, hey, we all are quitting, we're gonna quit our jobs and do this. And Sandy was the only one that even had a real job.
Yeah, she worked in like TV or something, right?
She did like scheduling for TV.
Yeah, that was it.
Like, we all got to, and the rest of us worked in like video stores and grocery stores and stuff. And but we were like, okay, we're gonna go for it. And so it was also just a consequence of that. Like, we have to make a living, and like, it just worked out that we put this record out and we got signed because we quit before, like a year before, I think the record came out, and we just rolled on a tour for like 6 years after that.
My recollection is just that you were always here.
We were here a lot, every 3 weeks.
Because there was the apartment that was above the Matador office.
Yeah.
And you guys were there.
I slept in the hallway.
Yeah. Or sleeping in the hallway of the office. But I just felt like you were permanently there, and now you are permanently here.
I am permanently here. Not in the apartment on Elma Road.
But UK resident.
Yes, I made it. Mm-hmm. The UK won the battle for my physical presence.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember when the record came out? Can you remember like release day?
Yeah. We had played a show in the west of England because we stayed at Ben's.
Oh, in Bristol, at
Ben's aunt's place in Bristol. So I remember like
Ben was your driver or Ben?
No, Ben Cook. Ben Cook.
Yeah. So I was like staying in a kid's room. Like I remember like sleeping on the floor, and there was like a bassinet in the room, and like cute pillows and stuff. And then waking up the morning, and then that was release day, so it was reviews and stuff, and I was reading them on, I guess, my computer. I didn't have a cell phone then. And then we would have played like a show like at some club in the west of England. Mm-hmm. So we were already on probably like a 2 month tour or something.
Yeah.
That was October.
Yeah, it was. I think it was October 8th.
So then we were probably here for like a month, and then we probably did America. What was the 12-hour thing?
Then you flew to New York and you played the 12-hour show.
So the 12-hour thing was like end of October?
I think it was mid-October. I think it was the 15th of October. Yeah. So it was technically release week.
Yeah, yeah.
So probably would have been Monday release date at that time. So
I remember we did the 12-hour show. We played the Market Hotel, I think, and then we played Bowery Ballroom. And there was like 14 people there because everyone was like, oh, the band that played for free for 12 hours, we're going to go pay. It was insane.
The Bowery was right after the 12-hour show.
It was the next day.
Oh my God, you must have been exhausted.
I was dead on my feet.
So for those, listeners that aren't aware, explain the 12-hour show. Can you remember who came up with the idea?
Me.
Right.
Yeah.
So I remember being plays for 12 hours.
It expanded, right? It was like, if this is our job now, why don't we do a show that's 9 to 5?
And then nobody would come show up at 9 in the morning to see Fucked Up Play. So it became start in the afternoon for 8 hours. Yeah. And then we might as well do it to 12 hours.
Mm-hmm. So where was it? It was on Bowery.
It was at the Rogan Gallery.
Okay, so we got... They flew us to your guys' offices to have a fat... You guys called them fat meetings, which maybe you still do. And I remember you were probably there and, like, all these people. And I was just... Yeah, they were like, do you have any ideas? And I guess we came to it like that. Mm-hmm. And then I remember, like, Robbie and stuff spent a couple months looking for a good venue. Mm-hmm. And I think for a while it was going to be at, like, the Turkish Baths in, like, the East Village. That was, like, the prime candidate until they found Rogan. So it was, like, a block away from where CBGB's is, just sort of,
across the street?
Yeah, you can see it across the street, yeah.
Just a sort of medium-sized, like, clothing store that... they could move all their clothes. So it was just like a black box room. Really cool building, which we were going to do a 24-hour show for the record from last year. So I spent last year like digging up like rental stuff for that building, being like, what could we just do it again there? But I couldn't find anything.
But it costs a little
bit
more.
It's the OVO store now anyway.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's Drake's store.
Yeah, he's not going to rent that to
you know. Torontonians, you know.
So the idea is that you would play, one of you would always be playing at some point for the 12 hours.
Well, I think we sold it as like, yeah, we're just going to play for 12 hours straight. And then it was like between us, like we'll just be on premises for a whole day, which doesn't actually sound that tricky because, you know, well, I'll be here for 12 hours. We probably played for like 8 hours of it and had guests. And so there was like something happening for 12 hours.
Yeah.
I'm going to just give myself a pat on the back and say, I'm pretty sure I did the most time on that stage.
I think you did.
And my joints were the size of basketballs by the end of it. And
you were also wearing a string bass.
At some point I switched into a string bass. Mad Men. No, I sang a Deep Wound cover with Jay Maskus on drums.
Yeah.
And I don't remember who played guitar, but that was a crazy day. Yeah. I mean, it started easily enough with, you know, when you start something really long, you think I can do this. And we played Crooked Head, the intro for Crooked Head, for maybe 5 minutes, which felt like an hour.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, surely that's an hour done. And it was not even anything close. Mm. We dragged it out and more people came. And, you know, the day went crazy, but it culminated in, toward the end of the night when I wasn't playing, I stepped outside with Ben and Michael Stipe was having a conversation with somebody on the street. And we went up to him and we said, you know, we heard you might be coming. And he said, yeah, it was cool. Good show. Nice idea. Like, you know, thanks for having me. I said, we heard you're a fan of the Feelies. And he said, I'm a big fan of the Feelies. And Ben and I sort of had this idea that Michael Stipe might show up, and we learned some Feelies song. And we were like, oh, you know, we learned this Feelies tune. Maybe you could come and play it with us. And he said, nope, no thanks. Put his scarf over his shoulders and bolted in the opposite direction. So that was like the one chance.
Hard no.
Yeah, it was a hard no. That was, you can only push your brushes with fame so far. So yeah.
But you had Moby.
We had Moby, which is the other interesting thing, because this is for a band that fabricates and does all these apocryphal things, or had done over the years. Moby maybe perpetuated the biggest lie about Fucked Up, which is that he saw us open for Youth of Today in Connecticut, and that's how he found out about the band.
I don't know who got him.
I was gonna ask that,
but maybe Dean knew him or something. But it turned out he didn't know what band he was performing with.
Oh, really?
He thought we were another band.
Who did he think that
Youth of Today? Because he played a Ramones song with us, and then we were talking to him after, or no, he did an interview for Rhapsody that we saw like a couple weeks later, and he's like, yeah, I remember seeing them at Anthrax Club in Connecticut in 1987. Fantastic. So it's good to see them again.
But did he not realize when he stood on the stage and saw, like...
likely not.
No.
Even Ben with, like, a real baby face.
He must have thought Ben was Porcel.
Wow,
probably thought Ben was Sammy. He's a young looking guy. Yeah.
That's I didn't what being know that vegan part.
Does. Yeah. Or maybe he just made that part up.
Mm. But, either way. And then who were the other guests? Jay Mascus?
Jay Mascus, the Les Savvy Fav singer, the Vivian girls.
Seal was on the flyer. Remember they put Seal on the flyer?
Really?
Yeah.
How the fuck were they going to get Seal?
I don't think they were.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Seal's like, you know any Cro-Mag songs?
Yeah, although yeah, yeah.
We could have just said he was there. What would anybody know?
I mean, there's a lot of people in there.
The Pope was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Famously.
Ezra, Vampire Weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was fun. He sang Blitz cover.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he called the audience nerds.
Yeah. What's up, nerds?
Yep.
That was good.
Which, fair.
Which they probably were.
Accurate.
Yep, but that's fine. Who else? John Joseph.
Yep. The internet's most famous pizza chef, Chris Hansel.
Who's that?
Warthog Chris.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he wasn't one of the planned celebrities, but, you know, he was there.
I haven't tried his pizza yet.
Me either.
Looks good, though.
Warthog pizza?
Warthog pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Pig pies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember you guys got us, like, a camper van, and there was a really good pizza. Probably not his, but there was good pizza in the camper van, so we could, like, decamp to this van for breaks, which is cool.
Mm-hmm. How did it end? What was the finale?
It was kind of a damp squib, because everybody had been playing... And it was like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, there's free beer, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And I think free vitamin water, because it was like 2008 was yeah, the era of vitamin water. Thing.
Possibly Sparks.
Right.
Sparks played, yeah.
Yeah. Sparks, the beverage, the band.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that at the end of that 12 hours, it was like, who fucking cares?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And I think Matador kindly got us a hotel room somewhere. Mm-hmm. To just sort of crash, and they were suites. They were like really weird family suites with pull-out couches and separate room and floral print stuff everywhere.
That's how you know you made it. If you have to work a full day, your label will buy you a hotel. Because you had to do something for 12 hours instead of just one.
But then still had to play a show the next day. Your hands must have been destroyed.
They were, I was like, my hands were like not very good at doing anything, but... I remember having a great set.
Yeah.
Like, for some reason, I had this, like, totally unnecessary resolve to play the greatest show that I possibly could and fight through the pain. And like I said, there was 20 people there. I'm upping it from 14 to 20 to seem more impressive.
Oh, yeah.
And I think somebody gave me a compliment. That, I think it was you, actually, Gabe. You said... This show was really all about you. And I think you maybe sensed
said that to me too.
My distress and, you know, tried to make me feel better. Yeah, you said it to everybody. You little son of a... But yeah, no, I mean, the show was wretched to play in this great place, so exhausted to nobody. But I don't know. Every show's a good show, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Nothing bad happens.
I wasn't even there.
I got hit with a light bulb in the face once at a show.
That was pretty bad.
I wasn't there, but I remember going to sleep. And then waking up, and then I guess maybe it was still going on when I woke up UK time.
Terrible.
Yeah. There is footage of it online.
You waking up and looking at your computer and being like
they're still going.
Yeah.
15 years ago, though.
Blink of an eye.
Yeah. Have you listened back to the record?
I only did two, because we played the set last month.
Mm-hmm.
And... I think I only listened to the tricky songs because we still played some of them.
Yeah.
I listened to about half of it.
It's hard to hear the songs that we've been playing in the set because we've just adapted them for the
show. Yeah, they don't
the show.
Sound the same.
They're faster. They lack bongos.
Mm-hmm.
All the sections are truncated and stuff like that. But I listened back before I had to relearn it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, like, why did we do that? Like, this sounds so strange. And it's so slow. And, like, I found all these faults with it. But listening to it to perform kind of brought me back to this place of playing them and, like, being the band that played all those songs live and wrote them. Because we're not really, you know, 15 years is a long time. Like, you remake yourself so many times, in that, especially as musicians who are consistently putting out music. The whole point is to...
simultaneously erase and build on what you've already done. But I came back to it before that show in October, the anniversary gig where we played everything. And I thought, that's a fucking great record. Like, it sounds good. The playing is confident. That's the thing, is that it's hard to exude confidence when you're rank amateurs that have been put into this position of getting everybody's attention. And that record has a ton of confidence and undeserved confidence. But nonetheless, we pulled it off. And like the rest of the, in comparison, some stuff starts to feel egotistical when you don't have that naive confidence of like, yeah, I can do this, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, Mike's already talked about lots of this stuff that was actually happening behind the scenes to make this record exist, which I think the rest of us, or me anyway, can often forget. Mm-hmm. But you hear it as a product outside of all of those things, even talking about them now. It stands as this like moment in which we felt able to make that record. Now we feel entitled to make that record. Mm-hmm. And we do it every 6 months. There's 10 records in the bag waiting. But yeah, it was a pivotal, you know, conscientious moment of creativity, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it just felt like an important moment, like an important record for that period of time as well. Like you said before, there was like a lot of people that were, you know, they weren't indie bands, they weren't punk bands, they weren't, there was like, you're No Age, you've got Times New Viking, Jay was obviously super prolific at that point, and you guys. And then I feel like a lot of those bands, it was like the shorter the song, the better. And then suddenly this record came along and it was like, the longer the song, the bigger. How many guitar tracks are there on that record?
I think we used to say like 150, yeah, but probably like, I don't know, probably 50 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I remember people back then were talking about Jay as being like the next Kurt Cobain.
Mm-hmm.
And so it always felt like, yeah, we were still getting to be like the weird band in the class of like weird bands getting promoted to whatever. But the music is one thing, but like to me, like that record is still just like, it was our last kind of like dealing with like the mysteries of the universe kind of shit that we were on back then, you know, like the art is incredibly weird and all the at least all my songs are about like fish and plants and all, you know, and it was like getting to have that stuff into a record that people were like taking seriously, I thought was very, very weird to me and cool, but
there was so much mystery around it all.
Yeah.
I think that's why, like, I definitely had, like you're saying, I can't remember the first time we met, but...
Well, it's mystery. It's clouded in mystery.
Yeah. But I do remember having, like, trepidation about it.
Because
it was like, who is called what? Do we use a pseudonym? Who is David? Is David the manager?
Yeah.
Didn't know...
I was still answering emails as David.
As David, yeah. Which was... unnerving and confusing. I think it was definitely there was a lot of mystery.
Yeah.
Which is
mysterious guy hardcore.
Yeah. This is amazing though, because behind the Wizard of Oz curtain is like the most dysfunctional quintet sextet of people that are like so unambiguous in everything else, like deeply flawed, normal, exceptionally normal personalities. You know, and grand, actually, no, I'm going to reverse that. We are the most abnormal personalities that can possibly... But, you know, like, you know, you don't walk in and see somebody shrouded in a cloak and that only speaks in haiku and riddles. Mm. You just get everybody...
You live on a boat.
Am I the mysterious one?
Yeah.
Okay.
You might tuck your shirt in, but, you know.
Let's be honest. I'm the most interesting one. I float through the universe physically and...
But I think that kind of stuff got us pretty far away. Because I think, like, people always talk about, like, okay, you must deal with a lot of stuff because of your name. But I think being obtuse like that and having a swear word as your name, like, helped us glide over some stuff. And, you know, have people like you or, like, people at the label, like, dealing with the band on that level probably made it a lot more exciting than just talking to, like, the five people in the band, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, that's why people in... arts do that stuff in jet at all, like, and we were sort of participating in a very long punk tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Just I personally was trying to imbue it with like actual magic stuff, because I was like really into the Grant Morrison magic stuff back then.
Yeah. But you know what,
Balagda.
Balagda. The idea that there was this like shim between the rest of the world and fucked up. It seems very unconventional, but most people do that with a manager. So like very conventional things. There is a physical person that's like, you can't talk to them. I'll do the talking and aggregate both these things. And having us be both of those people, or having Mike be both of those people, is interesting, because it's like, at some point, especially at that time, we had to answer these questions. Like, who is who here? Like, are we had to form ourselves as a working unit at that time, who knew what a production team was going to do, who knew what a management team was going to do, who knew what professional musicians did. And it was like everybody put all of those tasks in a hat and pulled a different one out every day. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, the mystique, I kind of, it leaked through the facade of the image of fucked up as being mysterious into the chaos of what it was like to be in the group, you know, because it, I mean, these things are still being codified to this day. Mm-hmm. And that moment of chemistry where bands flip over, I think lots of bands just have help and have management teams or like labels full, offices full of people that like solve their problems for them. And we're the connection with punk meant that we tried to constantly do it ourselves. And this is creates a very like hyper specific version of what a business model is, or what a working group of people is, and B, also like this amazing chaos that can never be replicated. Mm-hmm. And you know, we lived by the sword and died by the sword in that mm-hmm. sense. Like you don't take your youth into your adult life so often in the way that fucked up has, and it's mm-hmm. sort of like both refusing to change, or you could call that an evolution if you mm-hmm. wanted. So I don't know.
It's funny though, because the band at the time, well, I'm sure it probably is a similar way now, but everyone actually had their defined roles. Mm. None of it made any sense to me. It was like, okay, you know, Sandy's doing like the accounting, the money, whatever. You know, maybe you were doing like tour logistics or whatever. Damien would do the interviews because everybody wanted to speak to Damien. You were on your own thing. Whatever you were doing.
Thank you very much.
But everybody, no, but everyone did have their own, like, their own role, but none of it, the separate parts made no sense. But then it all kind of worked together. And especially when you would play.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, there'd be days where, you know, you guys would be staying in the flat and I knew that no one was talking to each other.
Yeah.
Because you were pissed off with each other, or just like needed space, or it just been, you know, it was like 20 days in a row or whatever. Mm. And then you'd get on stage and then that would all just fall away and it would all work really, really well together.
Yeah, the shows were like, the shows were very exciting mm-hmm. back then. And I think we were dealing with like transitioning out of an audience and transitioning into like a different professional environment, but also like doing it as five people that didn't really have any professional ambitions other than to just be able to make records and tour and stuff. And yeah, not knowing how to do, like, we all came out of DIY spaces and like, you know, we met each other at like a DIY record store, and so we were just used to like being in groups of people where you just had a job to do and 10 or 20 people just figure it out in this weird way. And that's what we did with the band. And it was like, yeah, just behind the scenes, just sort of like a dysfunctional but like egalitarian project where like everything was always split equally. And like, yeah, people just gravitate, like, you know, the more stuff you do, the more tasks come at you. Mm-hmm. And we had a good team of people with like at the label and booking and stuff, but we didn't have management to help us deal with that stuff and also try to propel us forward in any way. We were mm-hmm. just like taking it day by day and just trying to like be good instead of being big, really. Mm-hmm. And so probably from the outside, yeah, it looked really weird, but from the inside, those arrangements always seem very organic and like self-sustaining, mm-hmm. which, you know, 15 years later, that's probably why we're still a band.
Yeah. So you wouldn't change anything? I mean, would you change anything about the record or?
No. I wouldn't, no, not the record. I wouldn't have played that Bowery Ballroom show. But yeah, the record to me, the musically seems like when you like, you know, those like firecrackers that you nail to a tree mm-hmm. and those videos of like when it jumps off the tree and it's still spinning around the park and no, mm-hmm. yeah, that's what the record sounds like to me. Just like a really bright, uncontrollable thing mm-hmm. that you just have to wait till it burns out to touch it.
And you wouldn't change anything about the time?
Those was a good time. You know, like, I don't look back on that with any kind of criticality,
no.
in a sense, because it was just completely new.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that newness could have been changed to be any more new, you know?
Sure.
So if at the time, you know, in some kind of bizarre retrospective, you know, if there was something to pull that chaotic nature of the band together a bit more and help us use that to really propel us, that might have been nice, might mm-hmm. have been different, but you know, you can't regret you can't just go around regretting things, you know. I definitely wouldn't change the record. There's mm-hmm. a few drum fills that I regret, but like that's drumming.
I think we're all still making music all these years later, and I think that's all any of us really wanted to do or were yeah. able to do. So I think, like, back then, like, any new thing we would have taken on or gone after would have meant sacrificing something else, and probably we would have imploded if we took on any more than was allowable. So yeah, I think, like, it all kind of worked out.
Yeah,
it's been like 25 years or something insane. So
yeah, it's nuts. And like you say, I mean, you know, they're maxed out on what, 150? I mean, pretty much a show every other day, near enough.
That's too many shows.
It's too many shows.
Yeah. Doing that now, we would be dead.
Yeah.
Too bad. Yeah. I mean, we'd need an army of helpers, and yeah, we need Dr. Feelgood or whatever,
yeah.
or like one of those quacks from like Hollywood in the 60s mm-hmm. that just gives you amphetamines or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's a good, as a good concept to end on, or end on, I don't know, maybe you've got more questions.
I regret that Matador didn't give us like $10 million.
Yeah.
But
you could have at least given us the flat, or you know, I could have used it to live in.
Yeah.
Save myself being on the rust pencil. Court. Yeah.
Well, thank you guys.
Thanks, Natalie.
I mean, very important record for me. Still is. I listened to it again this week.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's
pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just check it out. 15-year anniversary edition coming out February, I believe, which is probably when this will come out.
Yeah. February. It's in the calendar. Nice, but none of you have access to that.
No.
So good luck.
See you in another 15 years.